I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of scent and the man who says he's figured out what makes smell so appealing. Luca Turin works as the top scientist at a company designing the molecules of which perfume is composed. He's become completely consumed with a search for and the appreciation of the finest ever made. He's partial to Shiseido's Nombre Noir and Houbigant's Fougère Royale. He says that one starts like a Bruckner symphony, a muted pianissimo of strings, giving an impression of tremendous ease and quiet power. Imagine, he says, approaching a white beach, and when you get closer, you realize it's a beach covered with all different sizes of white birds. And as the wind lifts them off the beach, first the smaller, then the larger birds, so the air lifts the molecules of scent from the smooth wrist of a woman. Interested? I'm back with Luca Turin after the news. Luca Turin talks about different smells we might all recognize. Vanilla, musk, sandalwood. He says that science has long known what's in them, but that figuring out how they work inside the nose, that's the real puzzle. Luca studied the idea of vibrations on membrane receptors, wondering if that's what causes the smell of something like sulfur to make us scrunch up our nose. He's read papers about inelastic electron tunneling spectrometry, and while the scientific explanation is what matters to him as a man in the perfume business, Luca Turin has developed his own wonderful nose for scent, and an ability to explain how. Not why, but how we smell. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Luca Turin says that a good perfume is like a poem, where each different molecule is a word, and the arrangement of certain molecules will create a certain scent. Luca says it's like a poem because each sniff is different as the smell of the perfume warms and ages and changes. He says you can find great depth and complexity there. One thing that Luca Turin will do when you meet him is remind you that he's a scientist with a doctorate in biophysics. And this perfume thing, it wasn't until he started exploring something like smell that people started asking him questions.
Every single thing I'd done before in science had been of interest only to me, or at best to a small number of people specialized in the field. My previous research topics had been the stability of membranes perfused with fluoride, the movement of lipid-soluble ions across tight junctions in membranes, etc. None of these had ever proved particularly electrifying as a topic of conversation. Smell was different. Everyone perked up when I explained what I was up to.
And Luca, why is that? Why do people like this subject as much as they do?
Well, it's one of these questions that people ask themselves when they're 9 years old, and then, because it doesn't get answered, they kind of forget about it. I remember when I was a kid, in fact, I was 9 years old, and a friend of my mother's, I think she must have been then about 35, she was tall, very handsome, in a sort of Amazon-like, very angular, aristocratic face with high cheekbones and small, dark blue eyes, and wore her hair short, wore tweeds, trousers, and she was very, very elegant, and she wore a man's fragrance. She wore Guerlain's Vetiver. And I thought she was divinely beautiful and the very essence of style. And in fact, she was. I mean, she, at the time, I think she was considered to be one of the most stylish women in Paris. And I felt totally in love with her. And I remember thinking that the fragrance that she wore, this thing for men, was really it, you know? The fact that she wore this masculine thing was a real statement, and it made a huge impression on me.
Did you ever buy it yourself, that fragrance?
Oh, yes, of course, of course. It's that particular one has been on my shelf since when I was 15 years old.
And this woman, did you see her again in later years?
Yes, I saw her again. In fact, we went to a fancy dress ball, and I wasn't in fancy dress, but I picked her up, and she was in her mid-70s, I think, at the time. She was still really beautiful. And she had on a stunning black dress. And, I mean, when she came in, the place fell quiet.
And the fragrance would have been a small part of that?
I don't know what fragrance she was wearing that day. I do know. By that time, she was wearing a dreadful, very loud jasmine, which smelt of town gas.
Oh, my gosh. I thought. Did you tell her?
No. I don't dice with my life.
There's a lot that I learned in reading The Secret of Scent, and one of the things was that the way perfume comes off a smelling strip or your wrist or wherever we're smelling it from changes almost from the moment that you begin to smell it. Have I got that right?
Yes, absolutely. Most people don't realize how small molecules are. When I calculate, I imagined molecules to be like birds of different sizes. You know, you have a huge flock of birds, and you have small ones and big ones. And I imagine that you sort of fire a starting gun, and they take off, and the small ones take off quicker than the big ones. So in a perfume, what you smell is an order of size. First the small, and at the end, the really big molecules. And when I calculated how big the beach would be if it were a smelling strip, it was 1,200 miles wide. So, you know, for a normal-sized bird. So molecules really are incredibly tiny.
There's a scene that you describe in your book about going to the perfume museum in France. I forget the proper name of it. What's the French name for it?
The Osmothèque.
Osmothèque. Yeah. It's like a church, the way you describe it.
It's a very strange place indeed, because the actual collection lives in a refrigerated room in the basement, and you have to be a member of the French Society of Perfumers, which I am, to visit and to have access to it and to smell the things. And when you walk in there, it's just jaw-dropping because all the great fragrances of the past, and there are hundreds, you know, that have vanished, that haven't been sold for, I don't know, 20, 30, 50, sometimes 80 years, are there, reconstructed, and you can actually smell it. And it's just incredible.
If you could go there now, if you were there now, what would be the one that you would choose? What would you choose to smell?
There's a fragrance called Iris Gris, Gray Iris, which was composed by Vincent Robert in the late 40s, I think. And it's a very funny fragrance because he took a lot of iris, and irises smell sort of like violets but dustier, and iris root. And it's a pretty depressing smell. I mean, it's pretty funereal. In itself, it's a pretty depressing smell, and has a kind of gray sadness to it. And he had the idea of genius of adding a beautiful peach note to it and to give it a kind of blush on the cheeks, I suppose. And the combination is just perfect. And it's funny because it's so simple, and I've spoken to various older perfumers in France who think that it's somehow unfair because Vincent Robert was apparently sort of lazy, you know? And he hit this formula of genius once and, you know, and was famous thereafter.
And it's not available on the market now. You have to go to the Osmothèque to smell it. Is that right?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's interesting because many times I've seen on perfumers' desks the smelling strips with Osmothèque written on them inside little sleeves. And oftentimes you see Iris Gris written on the smelling strip because every time they go there, they want to smell that too because it's so beautiful.
I like the part of your description when you go in with your guide.
Yes.
And you ask to smell it, that the guide will always smell it as well. What's that about?
You make an appointment, you get there, they take you down to this basement, and there are very large cans containing the master formula. So you have maybe, not very large, but half a liter or something, cans that contain the composition. And then a smaller bottle in front, which is the dilution to perfume level. And he just takes the smaller bottle and he dips simultaneously two or three smelling strips in it and then writes on them what it is and hands one to you and keeps the other one. And you're both standing there in this cold room with the refrigeration equipment going and smelling these things under the neon lights in complete silence. When you're smelling the great masterpieces, you're supposed to observe a respectful silence.
It must drive you crazy, though, when people wear it badly, when someone douses themselves with something. You've just flown across halfway around the world. I mean, in your wandering through airports, would I see you wrinkle your nose and scrunch up your eyes?
No, I tell you where it bothers me. It bothers me in concerts. When people dress up to go out, not infrequently, they splash it on. And so you see them half an hour later sitting next to you, and the smell gets in the way of listening to the music. But the worst thing is that there are some perfumes that simply do not agree with food. And in fact, my colleague, perfumer friend Guy Robert, said to me once that he believed that there's a certain class of fragrances called the chypre, which he believes that they've been very successful since 1917 when it was invented, that because they agree with food and wine.
Can you give me an example of a couple of brand names that we might recognize?
Well, for example, Chanel is coming out with an unbelievably wonderful one called 31 Rue Cambon.
You've already smelled it.
Yes. It's to die for.
Okay, describe it for me. You use such wonderful words to describe a smell. See what you can do with this one.
Well, okay. The original idea of Chypre is a combination of three things. It's bergamot oil, which has a very fresh sort of citrusy resinous note, very soft, sweet, soft, powdery thing, and a marine, harsh, ink-like note of oak moss. And that's the structure of the classic Chypre. So you have, in a sense, a complete personality from top to bottom. You have fresh, sweet, and dry. Okay?
The inky part at the end, is that the musk in the perfume?
No, oak. It's moss. It's a tree moss.
Okay,
it's actually the stuff that you see hanging from trees.
Spanish moss, we call it.
Spanish moss, that's right. And this one usually comes from Yugoslavia. And it smells very, very marine inky. Now, this is the classic structure. And it turns out that on this structure, you can hang all sorts of side things. It's like a tree. You can decorate it with all sorts of things. And people have hung all sorts of ornaments through the years. And this Chanel thing is particularly interesting because due to European restrictions on oak moss, they decided not to use it because oak moss contains some things which are supposedly bad for you. And they decided not to use it, and they made an accord from iris and pepper to simulate the oak moss. And it's wonderful because this constraint is like a piano concerto for the left hand, you know. They couldn't use the oak moss. And out comes this incredible fragrance.
And the iris pepper mix then is better than the oak moss?
It's different. It just takes away the austerity. It's just softer. And so it comes across as, and I don't normally use this word because I hate these associations, but this is a really feminine fragrance. To me, when I smelt it, it was exactly like, you know, in Rear Window when Jimmy Stewart is sitting there with his leg in plaster looking through his binoculars and Grace Kelly breezes in and she looks just indescribably gorgeous. And it sort of hurts. Well, that's what that perfume's like. When you smell it, there's a woman in there, and you wish you could find her, and you hope that she would like you.
If you're a fan of Grace Kelly, as Luca Turin certainly is, you'll recognize this as the theme from that film Rear Window. It's named for the Grace Kelly character, Lisa. In just a moment, I'll ask Luca how forward he is with people if they're wearing a scent he finds disagreeable. Will he say so? I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Luca Turin is a scientist who set his nose to uncover what he calls one of science's swords in the stone, the understanding of smell. Whether it's that pungent and lingering smell of frying onions or the alluring smell of not too much perfume on a passing stranger. How does it work? How do we smell what we smell? Is it the shape of a molecule or something even harder to define? In his book, The Secret of Scent, Luca Turin writes about one of his favorite perfumes.
During one of my periodic visits to the Galerie Lafayette, I noticed a shiny black arch in the corner of the perfume floor. This was the brand new walk-in stand for a Japanese company I'd never heard of, called Shiseido. And it showcased their first Western fragrance, Nombre Noir. I still remember the black-clad sales attendant spraying it from a black glass octagonal sampler onto my hand. The fragrance itself was, and still is, a radical surprise. Perfume, like the timbre of a voice, can say something quite independent of the words actually spoken. What Nombre Noir said was flower. But the way it said it was an epiphany. The flower at the core of Nombre Noir was halfway between a rose and a violet, but without a trace of the sweetness of either. And it seemed to be glistening with a liquid freshness that made its deep colors glow like a stained glass window.
That perfume is no longer available. Luca had some, but he says a girlfriend took it with her when she left. Later on, Luca says he traded one of his own treasures, a rare bottle of Coty's 1917 Chypre, for a spray bottle of Leroy's Nombre Noir. I asked him, how seriously does he take this? Is he the sort of person who would stop someone on the street to ask what they're wearing? Or would he tell someone that he didn't like their scent on a given day?
I once said to a colleague of mine at work, look, you just cannot wear that perfume. You know, it's just torture. She was pretty offended, so I tried. I made up for it by immediately running to the store to buy her a wonderful and highly luxurious and expensive thing, which she never wore. She carried on with her chemical thing, and it was awful.
What did it smell like?
It was Dior's Poison. It's called Poison.
I've heard the name, yeah.
It's a very distinctive fragrance, and it smells like cheap candy. And, you know, what's interesting about it is that it's a beautiful idea of perfumery. It's just that there was a point in the mid-80s where it seemed like everybody I disliked was wearing.
See, you do associate fragrance with people.
I'm sorry. This one I have to. I try not to, but in this case, I just can't help it. It was just a certain type of person. And it really, really was terrible.
If I was sitting with you in the doctor's office, would you be opening the magazines and peeling open those little smelling strips?
Oh, of course, yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes, I always do. I love those things.
See, I have a harder time with them because I can hold a magazine almost closed in my lap and go, oh,
yes.
There's a lot of smelling strips
in
this one. Do I really want to go there?
I know. It's a real cacophony as well because you can smell several at once.
Well, there's one smell which when you mix them all together is always the same.
Yes, absolutely. And it's the smell that when you walk into the lobby of a fragrance firm, there's always the same smell, which is a sort of, it's like a tutti-frutti.
It's like a bad barbershop is what it is. It's like chiclets, gum, and hair oil at the same time.
Oh, that's a good description. I'll just write it down for my next perfume article. Thank you. This is really good. Yes, exactly right. But some fragrances start out like that. There are some individual fragrances that are so complicated and in which everybody on the marketing team had some input. And when they're made, they sound like they're a mixture.
So how do you smell the magazine strip without your eyes watering, which often happens with
them? Actually, you know, in Europe, where I live, they've gone completely out of style. People complained. So they don't do that very much anymore.
Complained about what? They didn't want a magazine with perfume in it?
Yeah, they just don't want the thing to smell. I haven't seen them for a while. The real thing, of course, is the scratch and sniff. The real scratch and sniff, the one where you actually have to scratch it. And I remember this was in the early 70s. There was a wonderful advertisement for Coty's Emeraude. Emeraude is one of the great fragrances of all time. And the ad, and I still remember it, was a very tasteful nude in semi-darkness, a rather demure naked woman, the legs up front, and the arms folded around the legs. And underneath this very arty picture, there was a small gray square, and it said, scratch this. And underneath it said Emeraude, and I scratched it, and I can still feel it. It really was a shock. It was such a beautiful fragrance. But scratch and sniff is good because it has no smell unless you scratch it.
You talked earlier, Luca, about the Chanel perfume, not yet on the market, that has this wonderful feminine quality to it. Mm-hmm. Are there women's perfumes that are less feminine, a woman's scent, a scent marketed for women, that you would wear?
Yes, in fact, I think men can wear virtually any woman's fragrance, and I've done it many times myself, and nobody seems to notice. I think the idea is to wear rather little. I mean, it shouldn't be too loud. You know, a masculine fragrance, in my opinion, should be smelt only up close. A feminine fragrance can be a bit more radiant. So if you take any feminine fragrance as a man and you just put a small amount, it'll work fine.
And wear on
the
wrist?
You may not want to. No, actually, you can spray it on the inside of the sleeves of your jacket.
Uh-huh.
Just a couple of spritzes and that's it.
And do you do that so you can enjoy that smell with you wherever you go? Or do you do that because you want people to just pick up a couple of notes of that as you pass by them?
I do it for myself. I like the smell as I move, you know. I find it reassuring.
You know that there are offices and places where people with allergies to perfume have, you know, got enough signatures on a piece of paper to say that this place will be fragrance-free. Do you ever worry that this lobby will build to a stage where, you know, people can't wear perfume at a concert or in a restaurant, that sort of thing?
I think a compromise is being reached. I think very few people have true respiratory allergies, you know, as in when you spray a fragrance that your lungs actually constrict and prevent you from breathing. That's a very serious problem. Fortunately, it's rare. And I think one of the most active campaigners in this field has been a woman called Betty Bridges, and she's done a terrific job, and she's the bête noire of the fragrance industry, because, you know, using her website, she's alerted people to the fact that some of these things are quite strong allergens, and simply all that she's asking for is that the bottle should be labeled so that you know when you're buying a product whether it contains any of these things.
Is that reasonable?
Absolutely reasonable. I think people should know if there are known allergens in any fragrance product, people should be aware of that. In fact, the European legislation now demands that the allergens be listed. And, of course, it's a moving target, because what makes them allergens is the fact that people have been exposed to them in large quantities for a long time. So when you ban those or restrict them and replace them with other things, you're creating another set of allergens which you'll have to ban, and so on and so forth. But that's fine. That's how it is. Going beyond that to a phobia, you know, I mean, there is a tendency for people to latch onto sort of phobic things, you know, no fragrance. Mm-hmm. I wish people would have more serious things to worry about.
I did have an argument with a colleague here prior to this conversation. Not so much an argument, it's just a slight disagreement. And it was, are you meant to be aware of the fact that you're smelling the fragrance on someone that you're with, or is it meant to be something that really just enters the subconscious?
I would consider a fragrance that you're constantly aware of to be too loud. Mm-hmm. I really don't think that you should impose upon people. It's like, you know, speaking really loud into a cell phone. It's that kind of thing. And there are different moments. I mean, I suppose in the evening, you know, when you sort of sweep out to go out or something, you might have more stronger perfume. But generally speaking, loud is not good. If you work in an open plan office and you have three or four people wearing even moderately strong fragrances, it can be a bit of a drag.
My guest is Luca Turin. He's the author of The Secret of Scent. So what is the secret? Luca defines the question this way in his book.
The secret is this. Although we now know almost everything there is to know about molecules, we don't know how our nose reads them. Hundreds of times each week, chemists somewhere on Earth make a new molecule. In the days before safety offices, chemists used to routinely smell and taste the fruits of their efforts. They no longer do. Every time, it is an absolute mystery which each molecule is going to smell like. It's as if each new molecule were an inscribed clay tablet with a word written in an unknown script and a smell to go with it, like banana or rose or musk. The pile of tablets is now enormous, so big, in fact, that no one can have smelled more than a small fraction of the total. And we still don't understand how the things are written. The smell is encoded in the molecule using a cipher. This mysterious cipher is what this book is about. Like all good mysteries, it's hidden in plain sight. It has, if anything, deepened as our knowledge of smell has increased. Like most enticing enigmas, it's simply stated, what is this chemical alphabet that our noses read so effortlessly from birth?
That's Luca Turin reading from his book, The Secret of Scent. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. The answer to Luca's question is found in the nature of molecules, the way different ones behave, and the idea that our noses do with smells what a spectroscope does with light, that we unknowingly separate each smell into its component molecules. Luca Turin now uses this in his job as chief technical officer at a company that makes the components for perfume.
What I do is actually not fragrance composition. What I do is design the actual molecules. The company that I work for, which is called Flexitrial, is a research company which discovers new synthetics. So I design individual molecules, which then will be incorporated into various complicated mixtures as perfume.
So describe one for me that you're particularly proud of. Use the words to tell me what you've
designed.
Oh, we have
there's one which it was really strange. I've been looking for a Lily of the Valley smell for 2 years.
It's a strong smell.
Yes, and in fact, it's odd because Lily of the Valley itself does not exist as a fragrance material because there's not enough oil in the flowers, and there's not enough flowers for that matter. So you can't buy Lily of the Valley Absolute. So it's always been synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's a very, very popular smell because it's fresh green floral. And the two best Lily of the Valley materials, synthetics, are restricted now because they're allergens. And so we, in the company I work for, Flexitrial, we decided to search for a new Lily of the Valley. And I was beating my head against this particular wall for 2 years until last February, I had this epiphany. I was in Switzerland. There was one thing we hadn't tried. And I was on the phone to a friend, and I said, we're still not doing this Lily of the Valley. She said to me, I'm sure there's one thing you haven't tried. And so I put the phone down. I thought, she's right. There's one thing we haven't tried. And so I faxed my chemist a structure without even calculating it, which is what I normally do. And they called me back 2 days later to say, it smells hugely strongly of Lily of the Valley. And that was the best moment. And it is a really wonderful molecule. It's extremely powerful, and it has a terrific smell.
Does it have a name?
It's called Tannismal.
And will I get a bit of that in a perfume that's put together by some other company at some point in
the
future?
Yes, I believe so. I think, in fact, it's going to be used reasonably soon. I think within probably 18 months it'll be in several fragrances. I mean, many of them, remember, the meat of the business fragrance is in what's called functional fragrance. Fabric care, fabric softeners, shampoos. I mean, not fine fragrance.
Yeah, I understand.
So you may come across it in a cheap product. I hope so, because that means we'll make more money.
Luca, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Luca Turin's book is called The Secret of Scent. You can read more about it on our website at thestory.org.
I love your smell. I love the scent of you. Suits you so well, the adolescent redolence of you. I love the way when you walk by my sinuses swell. I love your smell. I love your smell. I love your smell. I like to sniff every sweet and sensual inch of you. Don't bathe too much. I even love the unwashed stench of you. Please don't freak, cause when you reek, you tell my jeans will mix real well. I love your smell. I love your smell. I love your smell. Oh, you're a whiff of a cold Chablis. You're a flowering apple tree. You're a big plate of gingerbread. You're a Shiner Box foamy head. You're popcorn and a candy bar. A big bed of roses and a brand new car. Oh, honey, can't you tell? I love your smell.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. On Monday, we aired a program on payday lending from both sides of the glass. Lisa Engelkins found that she needed to borrow money. She was a single mom working for $7 an hour. She didn't have credit. She didn't have credit cards. And she was ashamed to keep going to her parents for money.
It was right down the street. And I went in, and they had a poster hung up in the lobby that let you know if you borrow this much, then you write the check out for this much. And then this is the cash that we'll give you today. And then in 2 weeks or whenever your next payday is, they'll deposit that check to reap back the money that you borrowed plus their fee. Nothing was ever explained to me about what an interest rate was, like a disclosure or anything like that, because on paper it would have been like 400%. So they're not going to just jump out and say, oh, yes, come and get this money. You're only paying back 400%.
We also talked to the woman on the other side of the glass in such an establishment. Alba Onofrio was the woman who would be dispensing the cash.
So if people would ask, what's the interest rate? I would say, well, I'm not really sure, but you have to pay $20 every 2 weeks.
You wouldn't say it's like 470% or whatever it was,
yeah,
right?
I wouldn't have any idea. I would probably have even said, it's not a rate. It's you have to pay $20 per 200.
It's a fee.
Right. It's like a fee. Exactly.
After our program on payday lending, we got a number of letters. One listener wrote to thank us for the piece, though she didn't want her name used. She said, I'm listening to your story on payday lending and it's bringing back bad memories. I resorted to payday loans myself when my finances went down the drain. I had a car accident due to mechanical failure in the car, and delays in settling the claim drove me to the verge of bankruptcy. Gradually, I got out, but it was a stressful time. Sadly, my correspondent writes, my credit woes aren't resolved. I took out a $1,250 loan to purchase a computer to replace an old one, but I lost my job with 3 payments left on that computer, and that's $283 and change every 2 weeks. My bank account's overdrawn because although I called the firm, I couldn't get them to delay or suspend the payments until I got another job. So much for rebuilding my credit. We also got a letter from Jay in Biloxi who had a slightly more hopeful outlook. Jay wrote to say, most banks have an overdraft protection plan that anyone can sign up for. They charge a minimal fee, $5 to $10 per occurrence, and so you can pay a minimum charge per month on the balance, like a credit card, or just pay it all off at the end of the month. I think you did your listeners a disservice by not researching the existing alternatives to the payday lenders, especially for those that really need the overdraft protection service. Thanks to all of you for writing. We'd like to hear your story of managing your finances. Send me whatever you can about your story, and one of our producers will get in touch with you. You can find me at our website, thestory.org, or you can leave me a message on our telephone at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And this is the story of a very large pig. First, though, a bit about his biographer. Cy Montgomery has traveled around the world exploring and writing stories about strange places and wild animals. She'll tell you herself she would never have predicted she'd write a story about an animal in her own backyard, her own pet pig, Christopher Hogwood. But she did. She calls it the good, good pig. I asked her to read me the part about the pig eating.
We humans aren't allowed to enjoy food this much. To do so is labeled the sin of gluttony, and its consequence, if we're to believe the magazines, is clogged arteries, shapeless couture, and guilt. For many of us, food is the enemy. But while Christopher was eating, it seemed he was communing with his higher power. It was a beautiful thing to see.
Now, you have to answer the question, how it is a pig eating slops can be a beautiful thing to see. Because in my own imagination, it's just this sort of, you know, I don't even want to look at it. But
well, one, you know, someone enjoying something that much and you're not watching pornography, this is great. You could bring your children to watch
and
our
people
pig.
Did, didn't they?
Oh, they sure did. They totally did. And, you know, many of us think that pigs just hoover everything up in sight, but that's not really true. At least it wasn't with Chris, because he carefully picked out everything he liked the best first, and then second, and then third.
Would he eat what he liked best first or
yes.
save it?
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the dessert first kind of folks, you know.
How does a pig pick something out of slops, though?
Well, they have wonderful flexible lips. And he would pick things up quite delicately. I mean, he had very strong jaws, and he could crush a peach pit with his teeth. And you kind of wondered what he might do with your kneecap if it slipped in there, but happily that never happened. But eating was just, it was like a performance art with him.
I mean, how precise could he be with those lips? Could he pluck a half a donut?
Oh, he could get a grape. He could pick up one grape out of a whole mush of slops. Now, you know, he also could be kind of juicy. I mean, watching him eat was
It was quite an affair. Foam would flow down his jowls like champagne, you know. And
now that was his foam or the slop foam?
No, that was slops mixing with pig drool.
Okay.
Actually, yes. So it was an exciting thing to see. And he liked it if you hand-fed him things. He really liked that very much.
I had a friend when I was very small who was hand-feeding a horse a carrot and got her finger bitten. Did you have to be careful when you were hand—
Well, yeah. I mean, you did. He never actually bit anyone that I know of. But you wouldn't want to, you know, cover your hands in chocolate donut and thrust it into his mouth. But if you had, like, a long object, like a loaf of French bread, for example, he really liked it. If you held that out, he would bite it, eat that, wait for you to hand him another piece, bite that. If he had a
He'd like you to hold it so he could tear off his
Yes,
piece,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. He was using your hands like knife and fork, essentially. But he also really liked the interaction. And it was so much fun. Kids used to love to toss things into his mouth, like small round objects, apples and donuts and things like that, because he would hold his mouth open and you would toss it in like it was a basketball.
How big is a mouth on a pig Chris's size when he reached Chris's size? I mean, how, you know, a basketball hoop? I don't know.
Large. I mean, his head probably weighed over 100 pounds. So, and our heads, as you know, weighs 7 to 10, yeah. You know. So this is a very large head. And he also grew impressive tusks. And that was fun to see, to examine his tusks and to examine the ridges inside of his mouth. That was also very nice.
And he was tame enough or relaxed enough with you, Si, that you could explore the inside of his mouth without fear of losing a little finger?
Yeah. You know,
and was that a relationship he had with you, or was he just that easygoing with any human?
He was very easygoing, but I wouldn't, you know, want my friend's children sticking their little fingers in his mouth.
No, fair enough.
He loved, though, the human touch. And we had this thing called Pig Spa, and kids would come over, and we would massage him, we would bathe
him.
Okay,
now wait a second. You're skipping one of the best parts of Pig Spa, which is the exit from the barn up to the ridge where Pig Spa happened. Describe that for us.
Oh, man. How it came about. It wasn't my invention. It was the little girls who lived next door who came up with
Kate
it. Kate and Jane Cabot. My husband and I didn't have kids when I was a kid. I didn't have children as friends. I didn't know what you did with them. Christopher Hogwood's the one who taught me how much fun kids can be. Because it was they who decided that when his beautiful long tail became dirty and embedded with detritus after a long winter, this was the inspiration to comb the tail out and wash it and then do the rest of the pig. And pretty soon it got to be, you know, a several-hour endeavor and involved many people in the neighborhood, and people would come and bring their kids. We had to use buckets of warm, soapy water. If you used cold water, he would leap up shrieking like you're trying to butcher him. And he just loved the feel of little hands massaging him. He loved having his hair brushed, his tail braided. We would massage his hooves with this stuff called the hoof maker. Later, when he got older and he developed what we called porcine pattern baldness, we actually had this special, very expensive soap that the vet gave us. It was a foaming soap. And then we had to rub him down with vitamin E oil with aloe. But
this
he
was
loved
a very
it.
Pampered pig.
Oh, he was. I mean, it sounds really over the top, but we loved it as much as he did. And how often will you get anyone who will even sit still long enough for you to love them like that?
There's a part of the book that's kind of interesting about how Chris teaches you contact with humans. You say early on in the book that there may be a part of your soul that's more connected to the animal kingdom than you know, humankind. In what way did Chris connect you with people that you weren't already connected with people?
Well, I guess I'm a kind of shy person in a lot of ways. When I meet a new person, I didn't feel like I had a whole lot to offer. I mean, I would go to a party and think, like, what could I possibly say to this person?
Oh, that you've just come back from the Amazon where you were, you know, in some wild canoe and climbing trees and looking for some strange animal? I mean, that's what you do for a living. You're not short of things to talk about.
Not everybody really wants to hear about that. But interestingly, they love hearing about your big fat pig. And I had a motive to talk about the pig whenever I went to a party or something because I was always campaigning for slops, you know? And so Howard and I would go to some party and we'd end up talking the whole night about our pig and the people would come over the next day to feed him and it was wonderful. And I got to have interactions with people that otherwise I just wouldn't have known what to say to them or what to do with them. Even as a child, I was awkward with other children. I didn't want to play with their stupid dolls, you know. but when you're spending the day grooming your pig, that's my idea of a great time. And he also, early in his life, he was his brilliance manifested itself as a great escape artist. So he was getting out all the time, and he'd run around the neighborhood, and that's how I met everyone.
Digging up other people's gardens. Well, yes, actually. I'm surprised that they spoke to you after that. But.
I know. So one reviewer said that in Hancock, New Hampshire, they must have the nicest people in the whole world because they all ended up loving Christopher Hogwood, and they did. There's just something so jolly and uplifting about a pig, you know?
I want to go back just for a minute to his eating because there was – what was the year of the ice storm? Was it 97, 98?
98. Yeah.
That was a good time for Christopher Hogwood.
I know.
But you have to remind people about the ice storm and the aftermath. What happened?
Well, it was being portrayed as a natural disaster. It was a horrendous ice storm, and it knocked out power in about half of New Hampshire. And half of our town didn't have power for days or weeks. And what does this mean? Well, for my pig, it meant that the melting contents of all of Hancock's best stocked refrigerators were going to make their way towards his sty. Everyone knew about Chris and, you know, Yankee thrift. No one wants to throw that stuff away. And Chris, for the first time in his life, realized that he now has more than he could possibly eat. His wildest dreams have come true.
And the quality of the food, I mean, melting tubs of Haagen-Dazs ice cream and all this.
Yes, Sara Lee chocolate cakes. Oh, tubs of creme fraiche and things that you'd open up a slops bucket and you'd want to dive in yourself.
Now, wasn't it about that time, Cy, when the vet said, I think Chris may be getting a little large?
Yes, it was pretty much a direct result of the ice storm of 98. And happily, he wasn't as overweight as half of Americans are, relatively. He was more like, you know, the average guy out there who could lose 15 pounds. But he needed to lose 100 pounds.
How much did he weigh? At his heaviest, how much did he weigh?
Well, we think, and of course, we don't know this from his stepping on a scale. We know it from our pigometric measurements, which is basically a formula for a cylinder.
I'm coming back to that, but get to the number.
How much? He weighed about 750 pounds at his height.
This guy is almost the entire front line of a football team on his own. I mean, just think about the mass, right?
He was a big guy.
So how do you weigh a pig? I mean, do you have to take him to the truck scales along the highway? How did you do it?
Well, there's a formula that involves measuring around what they call the heart girth and then measuring from the middle of the head to the tail. And there's this formula that you do. If you go to the ag fairs and you have a little pig, you can actually get a pig tape measure that will tell you how much your little pig weighs. But
does
he outgrew it. He outgrew that. He outgrew everything. At one point, we had a dog harness for him. It started out with a little dog, then a medium dog, then a large dog. Then we started grafting pieces of other harnesses on it. We had to go to a climbing gear manufacturer who eventually custom-made something for him. But even that broke, which was kind of disturbing. And our cobbler just kept attaching more and more pieces onto his harness. And he could get out of his harness anyway, so it was really more of a costume towards the end, I guess.
You're listening to The Story. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest today is Cy Montgomery. We're talking about her pet pig, Christopher Hogwood. That's a name that's you borrowed from someone,
I bet.
Right?
The original Christopher Hogwood is a very famous, refined, and handsome musician and conductor, a founder of the Academy of Ancient Music.
Did anybody ever call you on this? Like, why did you or...
Well,
no.
Actually, the original Christopher Hogwood knows about our Christopher Hogwood. And we found out because after our pig died, there was a link to the obituary for our pig to the original Christopher Hogwood's webpage. So he does know about, and he understands what a tribute it was intended to be.
Well, that's nice.
Yes.
The name of the book that you've written, The Good, Good Pig, where did that title come from?
We used to rub his tummy. And if you rub down by the inguinal region where the back legs are joining the tummy, you can usually get him to just collapse in bliss.
Will
and
a pig purr?
He would grunt. And we would kind of grunt back. What we would say is...
What's a Christopher grunt? Is it like a soft...
like that.
Okay.
But usually in time to whatever you're saying
to the
him.
Or to the scratching?
We would say to him, you know, good, good pig. Fine, fine swine. Good, good, good. And then he'd...
Flop over.
And he'd just lie there grunting while you petted him. And if you stopped petting him, he would demand you continue. He just had such a great appreciation for that sweet savor of everything good in life, you know, from delicious food to the caresses of little children to the feeling of the sun on your skin. And he just connected, I think, everyone to that basic goodness and loveliness about the world.
There is a moment that you write about in the book I wanted to ask you about, and it was an afternoon when he drew you almost into a pig-like enjoyment of an afternoon. Do you know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, I totally do. It was right on the cusp of autumn.
Close to winter, but still a little taste of summer.
And the whole world just smelled like apples because our apple trees were ripening. And it was the kind of day you really should be outside. But I couldn't be because I thought, oh, I got to do these emails, I got to do these phone calls. But at least Chris could go out. But that day, he did not feel like going. I didn't realize that the next door neighbors, their grandchildren had just fed him a huge bucket of apples. So he wasn't going to follow me just because I was carrying grain.
Indigestion? Is that what was going on?
Well, no, he just wasn't hungry. So he was just going to go wherever he wanted. Right. And you can't just have your 750-pound pig blunderbussing around the neighborhood. I realized the only way that I could get him to stop was if I rubbed his tummy and just stayed with him that whole afternoon lying beneath this apple tree on a day that's really what I should have been doing anyway. I'll never forget that day, and I will never think, you know, in the moments before I die, gee, I wish I'd returned those emails.
Yeah.
But I'll always remember that beautiful day. I'll never forget that.
How long ago now, when Christopher died? 2.5 years?
Yeah.
And how old did he grow to be?
He got to be 14.
Was it like us, you know, a Labrador Retriever will only grow to about a certain age and therefore
we didn't know. We were on the cutting edge of science because very few people let pigs live out their natural lives. When people would ask us, how long does a pig live? We would say 6 months and their jaw would drop. And then, you know, you draw your finger across your throat because that's what they are literally killed at a tender age. But gosh, I wish he could live as long as a cow or a horse. I mean, I wish so much we could grow old together. It was after he died that I realized with the incredible outpouring of love that came in the wake of his death that I really did need to write this book. We filled every pickle jar in the house, every vase with flowers that came from people, phone calls, emails, cards from all over the world. People brought flowers to plant on his grave. People wrote me with their memories of him. He just touched so many people.
This I find fascinating because you're in farm country. It's not really that unusual to have a pig. And yet something about Christopher Hogwood or something about his relationship with you or something about his character created this community around him. Did you ever figure out what that was?
I gave it a lot of thought, and particularly after his death. He was a great soul. And I think that his kind of runt-to-riches story just made people happy. You know, here is a story that got turned on its head. You know, a pig who didn't turn into sausage.
Well, a pig who almost wasn't meant to be, who ended up maybe the best life a pig could
have. Right. I mean, he was too sick to live. All of his healthy brothers and sisters disappeared into a freezer long ago.
Right.
You know? But that success story, a success story that was bought by love, I think is something that makes people really happy.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dick.
The book is called The Good, Good Pig, The Extraordinary Life of Christopher Hogwood. It's written by Cy Montgomery. If you want to see pictures of either Chris or Cy, or the two of them together, Check out our website. We are at thestory.org. Let me remind you that there is a button on that website which you can push to send me a note, to tell me a story of yours, talk to me about what you're thinking, about stories that you're hearing on the program. We also have a part of The Story called Your Story, a place where you get to offer up that great story that you always tell at parties, only this time to the hundreds of thousands listening to The Story. Just go to our website. We are at thestory.org. We also have a telephone number where you can get in touch with me, give me the same information, 1-888-966-9862, 1-888-966-9862. And if you would like to write me a letter, the address is The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.